Richmond Radio Works presents Weird Tales. Here is your host, the darkly delectable Ms. Philippa Lovecraft.
Good evening, dearies. Thank you for lending me your ears on this dark night. I just adore getting to share stories of the weird and the fantastic with all of you. Tonight, I bring you two tales from opposite ends of the world that both delve into the realms of revenge and murder. Ah, we all love a good murder, don't we, dearies? There's just something about working through a grisly puzzle that fascinates us. The complexity of emotions that drive the murder. The methods that the killer used to send the victim into the netherworld. The clues that the detective used to unravel the mystery. All keep us intrigued until the conclusion of the case. I have selected some particularly engrossing page-turning plots for you tonight. In these yarns, even the identity of the killer is not completely as it seems. I know that this is a grand claim to make, dearies, but it will be proven as you listen to my tales. Our first story comes from the plains of 1930s Texas and the mind of the father of sword and sorcery, Robert E. Howard. Ah, a master storyteller was Mr. Howard, and as adept with horror as he was with adventure. I invite you to Cross Plains, Texas, and the study of John Kerouan, a well-traveled man who has long been a student of the forbidden arts. Kerouan is sitting in his study with Gordon, a handsome young man who currently looks deeply weary and troubled. The two men are about to have another visitor.
Come in!
Hello, Kerouan. Hello, Gordon. Haven't seen you for quite a while. How's Evelyn? Look here, you fellows. I've got something that'll make you stare. I got it from that robber Ahmed Mettub, and I paid high for it. But it's worth it. Look at this. It's a dagger from Afghanistan with rubies and sapphires.
Stop! Keep back! Get away from me, or...
What in the world? Is he drunk?
No, but something is bothering him. He looks as if he's at the end of his rope. Here, Gordon, drink this.
I'm sorry I went off the handle, O'Donnell. It was the unexpected shock of you drawing that knife.
Well, I suppose you thought I was going to stab you with it.
Yes, I did. Oh, I didn't actually think that. It was just the blind, primitive instinct of a hunted man against whom anyone's hand may be turned.
What are you talking about? Hunted? For what? You've never committed a crime in your life.
Not in this life, perhaps.
What do you mean?
What if retribution for a black crime committed in a previous life were hounding me?
That's nonsense.
Oh, is it? Did you ever hear of my great-grandfather, Sir Richard Gordon of Argyle?
Sure, but what's that got to do with anything?
You've seen his portrait. Doesn't it resemble me?
Well, yes, except that your expression is frank and wholesome, whereas his is crafty and cruel.
He murdered his wife. Suppose the theory of reincarnation were true. Why shouldn't a man suffer in one life for a crime committed in another?
You mean you think you are the reincarnation of your great-grandfather? Of all the fool notions. Well, since he killed his wife, I suppose you'll be expecting Evelyn to murder you.
My wife has tried to kill me 3 times in the past week.
Tell us the full story, Gordon.
You know, we've been married less than a year. All couples have spats, of course, but we've never really had any real quarrels. Evelyn is the best-natured girl in the world. The first thing out of the ordinary occurred about a week ago. We had driven up in the mountains, left the car, and were wandering around picking wildflowers. At last, we came to a steep slope some 30 feet high, and Evelyn called my attention to the flowers which grew thickly at the foot. I was looking over the edge and wondering if I could climb down without tearing my clothes to ribbons, when I felt a violent shove from behind that toppled me over. If it had been a sheer cliff, I'd have broken my neck. As it was, I went tumbling down, rolling and sliding, and brought up at the bottom scratched and bruised with my clothes and rags. I looked up and saw Evelyn staring down, apparently frightened half out of her wits.
Oh, Jim! Are you hurt? What made you fall?
It was on the tip of my tongue to tell her that there was such a thing as carrying a joke too far, but these words checked me. I decided that she must have stumbled against me unintentionally and actually didn't know it was she who precipitated me down the slope. So I laughed it off and went home. She made a great fuss over me, insisted on swabbing my scratches with iodine, and lectured me for my carelessness. I hadn't the heart to tell her it was her fault.
Probably for the best. There's no way she would have done it on purpose.
That's what I thought. But 4 days later, the next thing happened. I was walking along our driveway when I saw her coming up it in the car. I stepped out on the grass to let her by, as there isn't any curb along the driveway. She was smiling as she approached me and slowed down the car as if to speak to me. Then just before she reached me, a most horrible change came over her expression. Without warning, the car leaped at me like a living thing as she drove her foot down on the accelerator. Only a frantic leap backwards saved me from being ground under the wheels. The car shot across the lawn and crashed into a tree. I ran to it and found Evelyn dazed and hysterical, but unhurt. She babbled of losing control of the machine. I carried her into the house and sent for Dr. Donnelly. He found nothing seriously wrong with her and attributed her dazed condition to fright and shock.
Thank God. Car wrecks can be nasty.
Within half an hour, she regained her normal senses, but she's refused to touch the wheel since. Strange to say, she seems less frightened on her own account than on mine. She seemed vaguely to know that she'd nearly run me down and grew hysterical again when she spoke of it. Yet she seemed to take it for granted that I knew the machine had got out of her control. But I distinctly saw her wrench the wheel around, and I know she deliberately tried to hit me. Why, God alone knows. Still, I refused to let my mind follow the channel it was getting into. Evelyn had never given any evidence of psychological weakness or nerves. She's always been level-headed, wholesome, and natural. But I began to think that she was subject to crazy impulses. Most of us have felt the impulse to leap from tall buildings, and sometimes a person feels a blind, childish, and utterly reasonless urge to harm someone. We pick up a pistol, and the thought suddenly enters our mind how easy it would be to send our friend, who sits smiling and unaware, into eternity with the touch of a trigger. Of course we don't do it, but the impulse is there. So I thought perhaps some lack of mental discipline made Evelyn susceptible to these unguided impulses and unable to control them.
Nonsense. I've known her since she was a baby. If she has any such trait, she's developed it since she married you.
That's just it. Since she married me. It's a curse. A black, ghastly curse crawling like a serpent out of the past. I tell you, I was Richard Gordon, and she was Lady Elizabeth, his murdered wife.
Now, you spoke of 3 attempts.
Look here!
That had to be some cut to need that long of a bandage.
I came into the bathroom this morning looking for my straight razor. I found Evelyn just on the point of using my best shaving implement to cut out a pattern or something. She can't seem to realize the difference between a razor, a butcher knife, or a pair of shears. I was a bit irritated, and I said, Evelyn, how many times have I told you not to use my razors for such things? Bring it here, and I'll give you my pocket knife.
I'm sorry, Jim. I didn't know it would hurt the razor. Here it is.
She was advancing, holding the open razor toward me. I reached for it, then something warned me. It was the same look in her eyes, just as I had seen the day she nearly ran me over. That was all that saved my life, for I instinctively threw up my hand just as she slashed at my throat with all her power. The blade gashed my arm, as you see, before I caught her wrist. For an instant, she fought me like a wild thing. Her slender body was taut as steel beneath my hands. Then she went limp, and the look in her eyes was replaced by a strange, dazed expression. The razor slipped out of her fingers. I let go of her, and she stood swaying as if about to faint. I went to the lavatory. My wound was bleeding in a beastly fashion, and the next thing I heard her cry out, and she was hovering over me.
Jim! How did you cut yourself so badly?
Don't keep up this pretense, Evelyn. God knows what's got into you, but you know as well as I that you've tried to kill me 3 times in the past week. I guess I was a bit out of my head. My self-control snapped. Evelyn recoiled as if I'd struck her, and she stared at me as if I was a ghost. She didn't say a word, and just what I said next, I don't remember. But when I finished, I left her standing there white and still as a marble statue. I got my arm bandaged at the drugstore and then came over here, not knowing what else to do. Kerouan, O'Donnell, it's damnable. Either my wife is subject to fits of insanity... No, I can't believe it. Ordinarily, her eyes are too clear and level, too utterly sane. But every time she has an opportunity to harm me, she seems to become a temporary maniac. But it isn't insanity. I used to work in a psychopathic ward, and I've seen every form of mental imbalance. My wife is not insane.
Then what do you think?
Only one alternative remains. It's the old curse from the days when I walked the earth with a heart as black as hell's darkest pits, and did evil things in the sight of man and God. She knows in fleeting snatches of memory. People have seen before, have glimpsed forbidden things in momentary liftings of the veil, which bars life from life. She was Elizabeth Douglas, the ill-fated bride of Richard Gordon, whom he murdered in a jealous frenzy, and the vengeance is hers. I shall die by her hands, as it was meant to be, and she...
Just a moment. You have mentioned a strange look in your wife's eyes. What sort of a look? Was it of maniacal frenzy?
No, it was an utter blankness. All of the life and intelligence simply vanished, leaving her eyes dark wells of emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Have you any enemies?
Not that I know of.
You forget Joseph Rohlock. I can't imagine that elegant sophisticate going to the trouble of doing you actual harm. But I have an idea that if he could discomfort you without any physical effort on his part, he would do it with the right goodwill.
And who is this Joseph Rohlock?
A young dude who came into Evelyn's life and nearly rushed her off her feet for a while. But in the end, she came back to her first love, Gordon here. Rohlock took it pretty hard. For all his suaveness, there's a streak of violence and passion in the man that might have cropped out but for his infernal indolence and blasé indifference.
Oh, there's nothing to be said against Rohlock. He must know that Evelyn never really loved him. He merely fascinated her temporarily with his romantic Latin air.
Not exactly Latin, Jim. Rohlock is definitely not of Anglo-Saxon heritage, but he's not Latin. If I were to guess, I would say he's either Romanian or Armenian.
Well, what has Rohlock to do with this matter? He's been as friendly as a man could be since Evelyn and I were married. In fact, only a week ago he sent her a ring which he said was a peace offering and belated wedding gift. He said that, after all, her jilting him was a greater misfortune for her than it was for him. A conceited jackass.
A ring? What sort of a ring?
Oh, a fantastic thing. Copper, made like a scaly snake coiled three times with its tail in its mouth and yellow jewels for eyes. I gather he picked it up somewhere in Hungary.
Oh, he has traveled a great deal in Hungary?
Why, apparently the man's traveled everywhere. I put him down as the pampered son of a millionaire. He never did any work, so far as I can.
He's a great student. I've been up to his apartment several times, and I never saw such a collection of books. By the way, Kerouan, didn't you suffer some kind of unfortunate episode in Hungary? I vaguely remember you mentioning something about Hungary that night at the Wanderers.
Good God, are we all crazy? I came up here hoping to get some help, and you fellows faulted talking of Joseph Rohlock in Hungary. I'll go to Dr. Donnelly.
Wait. If you don't mind, we'll go over to your house. I'd like to talk to your wife.
Yes, we can take my car.
Jim, I'm so glad you're back. Oh, hello, Mr. Kerouan. O'Donnell.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Gordon.
Hello, Evelyn. You're looking lovely this morning.
Thank you.
We ran into Gordon here at the drugstore. It's been so long since we've seen the two of you that we just decided to stop by.
Yes, it has been a while since you've come to visit. I'm glad you decided to come by.
You have a lovely home, Mrs. Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Kerouan.
You certainly are a wonderful housekeeper, Evelyn. Gordon never could keep a clean room. He's blessed to have you to brighten up the place.
Thank you.
Mrs. Gordon, that is a remarkable ring you are wearing. Do you mind if I look at it?
Oh, I'll have to give you my hand. I've been trying to get it off today, and it won't come off. Oh, it's evil looking, isn't it? Oh, at first I liked it, but now I can hardly bear to look at it. If I can get it off, I intend to return it to Joseph, Mr. Roelock. I'll answer it, Jim. I know who it is.
Howdy, Jim. Howdy, Mr. Kirowan. Hey, O'Donnell. Have you got any firearms with you? Last time you nearly blew my head off showing me an old flintlock pistol that wasn't supposed to be loaded.
Dr. Donnelly! Dr. Donnelly, I sent for you and Uncle Bill for the same reason for which I know Jim has brought Mr. Kirowan and Michael. There's a matter Jim and I can no longer deal with alone. There's something between us, something black and ghastly and terrible.
What are you talking about, girl?
My husband. My husband has accused me of trying to murder him.
You young pup, I'll knock the living daylights.
Sit down, Bill. No use going off half-cocked. Go ahead, honey.
We need help. We cannot carry this thing alone. This morning, Jim's arm was badly cut. He said I did it. I don't know. I was handing him the razor, and then I must have fainted. At least, everything faded away. When I came to myself, he was washing his arm in the bathroom sink, and he accused me of trying to kill him.
Why, the young fool, hasn't he had sense enough to know if you did cut him, it was an accident?
Shut up, won't you? Honey, did you say you fainted? That isn't like you.
I've been having fainting spells. The first time was when we were in the mountains, and Jim fell down a cliff. We were standing on the edge, and then everything went black. And when my sight cleared, he was rolling down the slopes. Oh, and then when I lost control of the car and it crashed into the tree. You remember, Jim called you over.
Yes, I remember. I don't remember you ever having fainting spells before.
But Jim says I pushed him over the cliff. He says I tried to run him down in the car. He says I purposely slashed him with the razor.
How about it, son?
God help me, it's true.
Why, you lying hound! If you want a divorce, why don't you get it in a decent way instead of resorting to these despicable tactics?
Damn you! If you say that again, I'll tear your jugular out.
Evelyn, you know I love you. I feel like a dog. But God help me, it's true. If we go on this way, I'll be a dead man and you...
Don't say it! I know you wouldn't lie to me, Jim. If you say I tried to kill you, I know I did. But I swear, Jim, I didn't do it consciously. Oh, I must be going mad. That's why my dreams have been so wild and terrifying lately.
Of what have you dreamed, Mrs. Gordon?
A black thing. A horrible, faceless black thing that moans and mumbles and paws over me with apish hands. Oh, I dream of it every night. And in the daytime, I tried to kill the only man I ever loved. I'm going mad. Maybe I'm already crazy and don't know it.
Calm yourself, honey. We'll talk this all over and everything's gonna be okay. Give me a match, honey. I'd like to light a cigar.
There are matches in the drawer, Evelyn. No, no, don't open that drawer. Don't!
Evelyn, what's wrong? All of the light has gone out of your eyes. It's almost as if your soul is gone.
Leave him to Bane and Donnelly, O'Donnell. We are hunters, not healers. Lead me to the house of Joseph Roelock.
What in the world?
James Gordon's been shot.
Shot? When did she kill him?
She? How did you know?
John Kirowan.
You remember me, Joseph Roelock.
Years ago, when we delved in the dark mysteries together in Budapest, I saw where you were headed. I drew back. I would not descend to the foul depths of forbidden occultism and diabolism to which you sank. And because I would not, you despised me, and you robbed me of the only woman I ever loved. You turned her against me by means of your vile arts, and then you degraded and debauched her, sank her into your own foul slime. I would have killed you with my hands then, Josef Vrolok, vampire by nature as well as by name that you are. But your arts protected you from physical harm. But you have trapped yourself at last. You sought the destruction of James Gordon and his wife because she unwittingly escaped your snare. You tried to...
You are mad. I have not seen the Gordons for weeks. Why blame me for the family troubles?
Liar, as always. What did you say just now when O'Donnell told you Gordon had been shot? Then did she kill him? You were expecting to hear that the girl had killed her husband. Your psychic powers had told you that a climax was close at hand. You were nervously awaiting news of the success of your devilish scheme. But I did not need a slip of your tongue to recognize your handiwork. I knew as soon as I saw the ring on Evelyn Gordon's finger. The ring she could not remove. The ancient and accursed ring of Tothamon, handed down by foul cults of sorcerers since the days of forgotten Stygia. I knew that ring was yours, and I knew by what ghastly rites you came to possess it. And I knew its power. Once she put it on her finger in her innocence and ignorance, she was in your power. By your dark magic you summoned the black elemental spirit, the haunter of the ring out of the gulfs of night and the ages. Here in your accursed chamber you performed unspeakable rituals to drive Evelyn Gordon's soul from her body, and to cause that body to be possessed by that godless sprite from outside the human universe. She was too clean and wholesome, her love for her husband too strong, for the fiend to gain complete and permanent possession of her body. Only for brief instants could it drive her own spirit into the void and animate her form. But that was enough for your purpose. But you have brought ruin upon yourself by your vengeance. What was the price demanded by the fiend you drew from the pits?
Fiend from the pits? What pits?
You blench. Josef Vrolok is not the only man to have learned forbidden secrets. After I left Hungary, a broken man, I took up again the study of the black arts to trap you, you cringing serpent. I explored the ruins of Zimbabwe, the lost mountains of Inner Mongolia, and the forgotten jungle islands of the southern seas. I learned what sickened my soul so that I forswore occultism forever. But I learned of the black spirit that deals death by the hand of a beloved one, and is controlled by a master of magic. But Josef Vrolok, you are not an adept. You have not the power to control the fiend you have invoked, and you have sold your soul.
You lie. I did not promise him my soul.
I do not lie. I know the price a man must pay for calling forth the nameless shape that roams the gulfs of darkness. Look. There in the corner behind you, a nameless, sightless thing is laughing, is mocking you. It has fulfilled its bargain, and it has come for you, Josef Vrolok.
No. No! I tell you, it was not my soul. I promised it a soul, but not my soul. He must take the soul of the girl, or of James Gordon.
Fool! Do you think he could take the souls of innocence? That he would not know they were beyond his reach? The girl and the youth he could kill, aye. Their souls were not his to take, or yours to give. But your black soul is not beyond his reach, and he will have his wage. Look, he is materializing behind you. He is growing out of thin air. Look behind you, fool. I see him. He has come. He is here. His grisly mouth gapes in an awful laughter. His misshapen paws reach for you.
No! No! You weren't supposed to take me! No! Please! No!
Come on, O'Donnell! Let's get out of here before the fiend turns on us!
Eccentric scholar found dead. Josef Vrolok, a wealthy scholar, was found dead in his sumptuous apartment this morning. There were no marks upon the body, and the deceased appeared to be in good health. The police are conducting an investigation into Rolock's sudden death, where preliminary findings indicate that he most likely died of heart failure.
The paper is full of good news this morning. Did you see the brief item about Gordon on page 3?
Here it is. A pistol accidentally discharged in the home of James Gordon yesterday afternoon. Dr. Donnelly was visiting the Gordon home at the time and gave immediate aid. James Gordon suffered a slight scalp wound but was otherwise unhurt.
Yes. Mrs. Gordon has the strongest will I have ever seen. Not many would have been able to alter that foul demon's aim.
Gordon's theory of reincarnation was wild enough, but the actual facts were still more incredible. Tell me, Kuroan, was that last scene the result of hypnosis? Was it the power of your words that made me seem to see a black horror grow out of the air and rip Joseph Rolock's soul from his living body?
No. No human hypnotism would strike that black-hearted devil dead on the floor. No, there are beings outside the ken of common humanity, foul shapes of transcosmic evil. Such a one it was with which Rolock dealt.
But how could it claim his soul? If indeed such an awful bargain had been struck, it had not fulfilled its part, for James Gordon was not dead, but merely knocked senseless.
Rolock did not know it. He thought that Gordon was dead, and I convinced him that he himself had been trapped and was doomed. In his demoralization, he fell easy prey to the thing he called forth. It, of course, was always watching for a moment of weakness on his part. The powers of darkness never deal fairly with human beings. He who traffics with them is always cheated in the end.
It's a mad nightmare. But it seems to me, then, that you brought about Rolock's death just as much as anything else.
It is gratifying to think so. Evelyn Gordon is safe now, and it is a small repayment for what he did to another girl years ago and in a far country.
It is indeed. Thus ends the tale of the Haunter of the Ring, where black arts were utilized to force a loving wife to murder her husband. As effective as magic can be to bend others to your will, there are other, more subtle ways to compel someone to murder another, as we shall see in our next tale. I take you now from the plains of 1930s Texas to the cherry blossoms of 1950 Japan and the mind of Edogawa Rampo, one of the greatest names in Japanese mystery fiction. Oh, Rampo was a macabre one. Fascinated with the grotesque and the ghoulish, he knew the darkest corners of the human mind, and was a master at bringing the desires of those corners out in the open. I invite you to a quiet bench on a cliff near a hot spring resort. Here sit a young married couple who are enjoying a holiday together. All is quiet, peaceful, and solitary. A perfect place and time to think through past events.
Isn't it odd that in all this time we've never discussed those incidents that keep preying on our minds so? Sometimes I think I'll suffocate if I don't discuss them. Since we have so much free time today, let's talk about the things of the past a little. You won't mind, will you, darling?
Of course not, dear. You go ahead and I'll add my comments from time to time.
Well, let's see. To begin at the beginning, there was that night when I was lying in bed, side by side with Saito. He was weeping as usual, with his face pressed against mine, and his tears kept trickling into my mouth.
Don't be so explicit. I don't want to hear the details of your intimacies with your first husband.
But this is an important part of the story, because that was when I first had a clear insight into his plans. But all right, for your sake, I'll omit the details. So, it was just as I tasted the salt of his tears that I suddenly told myself something was wrong. The way he was crying that night was far more intense than usual, as if he had some hidden reason. Startled, I drew back and looked into his tear-stained eyes.
That must have made your blood run cold, to have your married happiness suddenly turn into fear. I remember you telling me that he seemed to have pity in his eyes as he returned your look.
Yes, his eyes spoke eloquently of the pity he felt for me. I believe a man's innermost secrets can be read in his eyes. And on this occasion, certainly, Saito's eyes were so eloquent that I perceived his thoughts instantly.
He was planning to kill you, wasn't he?
Yes. But of course, the whole thing was only a sort of game for him. In many ways, he was a sadist, as you know, and I was just the opposite. I'm sure that's why he wanted to play the game. There's no denying that we loved each other, but we both incessantly craved more excitement.
I know. You needn't say any more.
That night was the first time I felt I could plainly read his mind. Vague suspicions had disturbed me for some time, but now real fear gripped my heart. I shuddered to think he would go to such lengths. But I was thrilled in spite of my fears.
That look of pity you saw in his eyes, that was part of the game too, wasn't it? He wanted you to be frightened, and this was his way of hinting at what was in store for you. And then...
Then there was the man in the blue overcoat.
Yes, with the blue felt hat, dark glasses, and a thick mustache.
You'd seen him before, hadn't you?
Yes, there I was, a striving painter boarding at your house, playing the role of a clown in the midst of you and your husband's affairs. It was one day while I was out roaming the streets that the man first attracted my attention. And when I asked the owner of the tea house on the corner, she told me that the stranger had been asking a lot of questions about your house.
It was after you brought me this news that I happened to see him myself. The first time was outside my kitchen, and twice more near the front gate. Each time he was standing like a shadow, dressed in his baggy overcoat, both his hands shoved deep in his pockets.
I thought he was a sneak thief at first, and several servants in the neighborhood also warned me about him.
But he turned out to be much worse. A far more dangerous character than a mere sneak thief, didn't he? Somehow that dreadful night, his sinister form leapt to my mind the instant I gazed into my husband's tear-stained eyes.
And then you had a third hint of his plans, didn't you?
Yes. Those detective stories you started bringing us. We'd read detective stories before, of course, but you really aroused our interest in the art of crime. It all started a few months before we saw the mysterious stranger. And almost every night we used to discuss nothing but various successful crimes. Saito, my husband, of course, was the most enthusiastic of all, as you may recall.
Yes, that was about the time he brought up the best plot of them all.
You mean that trick of dual personality? There certainly were a lot of different ways of creating a dual personality, weren't there? I remember that long list you made up.
33 different ways, if I remember correctly.
But Saito was most impressed with the possibility of creating an utterly non-existent character.
The theory was a simple one. For example, if a man decided to commit a murder, he would first create an imaginary character far in advance of the crime. This character would be his double. His description would be simple, with, say, a false mustache, dark glasses, and conspicuous clothing. Then he would have this double of his establish a residence far removed from his real home. And then he would proceed to live two lives. While the real character would supposedly be away at work, the double would be at his home, and vice versa. Matters would be even more simple in the event one of the two characters went on a long trip. With the stage thus set, the murder could be committed at an opportune time, but immediately before the crime, the imaginary character would make himself very obvious to several witnesses. And then, following the crime, he would vanish completely from the face of the earth. Beforehand, of course, he would have destroyed all incriminating evidence, such as his disguise. As a result, he would be permanently missing from his home, while the real character would merely resume his former way of life. Naturally, as a crime was committed by a non-existent character, it would be a perfect crime.
Saito kept talking about this until I thought he was going crazy. All this I recalled as I stared into his eyes. But there was one more clue to his hidden thoughts. It was that diary, which he had pretended to hide for the express purpose of having me find it. But the diary was planted for me to read, so of course it didn't mention his real secrets. For example, there was not a word about his mistress.
It was like crossing out lines in a letter to make sure they'd be read.
I read that diary from cover to cover. Several pages were devoted to the dual personality idea. I was quite struck by his ingenious ideas. And I must say, he was a wizard with the pen.
Go on.
Well, those are the three clues I had. First, the look in his eyes. Next, the man in the blue overcoat. And finally, the diary describing the dual personality trick. But somehow I had the feeling that the picture was incomplete. There seemed to be no motive. You supplied this when you told me about the mistress. After that, I could never look into his eyes without seeing there the reflection of some beautiful girl I imagined his mistress to be. At times, I even thought I could smell her perfume on him.
In other words, these four clues convinced you that he was planning to kill you so that he could get the fortune you inherited from your father and then live with his mistress.
Yes. But at the same time, I knew he was only playing a game to frighten me.
Yes, maybe that's what you thought, but his motive was real enough. His plan was to steal into your bedroom in disguise, kill you, and vanish. Later, the real Saito would return, discover your murder, and play the delicate role of the grief-stricken husband.
Yes, but as I said before, it was only part of the same game to frighten me, and to enjoy the thrill of suspense. You can imagine what a horrible game it was. That was the thrill he was aiming for. It's surprising how all these details came to mind with full clarity in the split second I stared into his eyes.
But where was Saito supposed to draw the line? What was the actual purpose of his disguise as a man in the blue overcoat?
I think he really intended to steal into my bedroom, in his disguise, and frighten me out of my wits. Then, after enjoying my hysterics, he would burst out laughing.
But that isn't the way it turned out, is it?
It certainly wasn't. Until then, everything had more or less been a joke. But what happened next nearly froze the blood in my veins. I shudder every time I think about it.
No more than I do. But go on. Get it off your chest now that there's nobody to hear us.
All right. Several more times he went into weeping hysterics in bed, and gradually I began to realize that I couldn't fathom the look in his eyes any longer. In fact, I no longer knew if he was playing a game or...
You began to suspect that he was planning to kill you, didn't you?
Yes. Now his glassy, staring eyes seemed to be saying, "At first I created an imaginary character to give you a wonderful thrill. But now, having played the game thus far, I'm becoming confused. How easy it would be to really kill you and yet remain utterly unsuspected. Besides, you have a large fortune, which would become mine. What a temptation. For really, you know, I love someone else far more than you. But I do pity you. Really, I do." In these tormenting nights, my fears grew stronger and stronger. And it was about this time, with my thoughts in a turmoil as we grappled and tangled in the dark of the bedroom, that I began again to taste his salty tears trickling into my mouth.
That's when you came to talk to me.
Yes, but you said I was hysterical and tried to laugh my fears away. But in spite of your laughter, I saw a hidden shadow in your eyes, and I began to suspect that you had the same fears as I.
You may have thought so, but that wasn't the case at all. You've always had the piercing eyes of a mind reader, haven't you? Not many people have your power of reading the subconscious mind.
After that, I was always afraid to look into his eyes. And even more, I feared that he might be able to read my eyes. Gradually, the thought of his pistol began to prey on my mind. One evening, I saw the man in the blue overcoat outside the gate again. It was almost dark, but I thought I could see him leering at me. A cold shiver ran down my spine, and that instant I again remembered the pistol, the one hidden in the drawer of Saito's desk.
I also knew about the pistol. He knew that it was against the law to keep firearms, but he kept it anyway, fully loaded, and hid it in one of the desk drawers, merely for the sake of having it, I thought.
It suddenly struck me that the man in the blue overcoat might have that pistol in his pocket. I went immediately to Saito's desk and examined the drawer. But the pistol was there, and I felt immediately relieved. Then I had another thought. I said to myself, surely if the man is Saito in disguise, he wouldn't be such a fool as to use his own pistol. This means he must be planning to use a different weapon. And thus my fears kept growing all the more.
So you decided to take that pistol for your own protection?
Yes. I took it out of the desk and kept it with me all the time. At night I even slept with it.
The existence of that pistol was unfortunate, because if it had not existed...
That's when I ask you what would happen to me if a man stole into my bedroom at night and I shot him, even if he hadn't been planning any crime. Remember?
Yes, and if I remember correctly, I told you that this would constitute self-defense and would not be considered a crime. Later on, I was sorry I told you this.
And then, sure enough, he finally came. It was past midnight. He climbed over the fence and stole into the house through the kitchen window. The first thing I knew, I saw my bedroom door opening slowly, and then I saw him. It was him, all right. He wore the same blue overcoat. His felt hat was pulled low, and his dark glasses covered his eyes. And that awful mustache? Now was the time. I pretended to be asleep, but stole a glance at him and gripped the pistol.
And then?
I could almost hear my heart beating. I wanted, oh, how I wanted to pull the trigger, but I waited. He was standing there in the doorway, both hands in his pockets. Somehow, I felt he knew I was only pretending to be asleep. For what seemed like an hour, we both watched each other. I wanted to scream, to leap out of bed and flee, but I gritted my teeth and held myself in check.
And then?
Suddenly he began to move toward my bed. I peeped out from under the covers and saw his face looming beside the night lamp. He was cleverly disguised, but I could see that he was definitely Saito. His eyes behind the dark glasses seemed to be smiling. Gradually his face came closer and closer. I couldn't see the knife in his hand, but there was no mistaking that he meant to kill me. I turned the pistol slowly under the covers and aimed at his heart. Then I pulled the trigger. That's what brought you and the maid running in, but by that time I had fainted.
As soon as I saw the dead man, I knew what had happened. The knife was lying beside him.
So the police came, and a few days later you and I were summoned to the procurator's office. I told the whole story from beginning to end with you as a witness, and they soon released me. It was the knife you'd found on the floor that proved I killed Saito in self-defense. After that, I had a nervous breakdown and spent a month in bed. How I appreciated the way you came to see me every day, taking the place of the friends and relatives I didn't have. You even took care of that matter of Saito's mistress for me.
And now, just imagine, a year has already passed, and we've been married for over 5 months. Well, let's get back to the inn.
No, there's more to talk about.
Really? What else is there to say? Haven't we already covered the ground completely?
Yes, but so far we've only touched the surface of things.
The surface of things? It seems to me that we've analyzed the matter quite thoroughly.
But you forget, my dear, that behind one curtain, there's always another.
For the life of me, I don't know what you mean. You're acting strangely today.
You're afraid, aren't you? If it were possible for a man to force another to commit a serious crime merely by the power of suggestion, what a great satisfaction he must derive. Using an unsuspecting puppet to carry out his designs, he would be utterly safe from discovery. This, I think, is the perfect crime that we never discuss.
What the devil do you mean?
I'm only trying to tell you what kind of a man you really are. But don't be alarmed. I have no intention of going screaming to the police. I'm quite an understanding woman, you know. Come now, let's not mince words.
Oh, listen, it's getting late.
See, I told you. You're afraid of me. But I simply hate to leave a story unfinished. So please, let me continue. To you, Saito was an ideal puppet. First, you awakened his interest in detective stories. Then you convinced him that the trick of the dual personality was foolproof. And bit by bit, by the power of suggestion, you led him deeper and deeper into the pit of crime. The fact that Saito had a mistress was a mere accident, but you used this too.
You're crazy. It's easy to put two and two together to fit any pattern.
But think back. You know only too well that it was always you, and you alone, who made one event lead to the next. Until I finally killed Saito. It was all your doing, by the sheer power of your suggestions. And you know it.
But you're forgetting one thing. You might not have killed Saito.
In that case, you would have adopted some other strategy. Of all the kinds of criminals, you're the most cunning. For your strategy was based on probabilities. If one plan went wrong, you would have quickly thought up another. And another. One of them was sure to succeed. And without your ever being suspected. Yes. You did indeed commit the perfect crime.
You're beginning to annoy me. You've made up your story out of thin air, and it's sheer nonsense. I'm going back to the inn.
Look at you. Your face is covered in sweat. Don't tell me you're not feeling sick. But you'll have to hear me out. When I pulled the trigger of that pistol, I didn't see Saito holding any knife. I was only guessing that he was trying to kill me. So I killed him. But I had another reason, too. I loved you, and you knew it. I didn't see the knife until after I recovered from the fainting spell. And there it lay beside Saito's body. Now, you were the first to arrive on the scene after I killed Saito. And how utterly simple it would have been for you to put Saito's fingerprints on the knife and plant it beside his body. You thus not only got rid of Saito, but also provided evidence for my plea of self-defense.
Your powers of imagination are truly amusing.
You can't fool me with your laughter. Look, you're trembling. You needn't, you know. I'm not going to tell anyone. How could I betray you after you've gone to such great pains to get me? I only wanted to talk this over with you, just once. I won't tell anyone, never fear. We've certainly bared our innermost thoughts today, haven't we? But there's one more thing I should tell you. I loved you only for yourself, but you loved my money as well as myself. And now, it's only my money you want. I know this. And you know that I know it. Isn't it so? That's why you brought me to this lonely spot today. Just like Saito, you can't live without my money. So you've begun to wish I'd have an accident. If something happened to me, of course, you would inherit all my money because you are my husband. I even happen to know that you, too, have a mistress. And that you hate me for being in the way. Self-defense again. How funny. A year ago, Saito tried to kill me. But he was the one who was killed, not I. And now that fool tried to push me off this cliff. But he was the one who fell off. I was the real killer of both. But the law won't punish me. How easy it is to kill. Who knows? Maybe I really am the witch I seem. Maybe I'm destined to go on forever, killing one husband after another.
Maybe. Maybe. Thus ends the tale of the cliff, where Saito was manipulated into playing a game that led to his death. and the line between victim and mastermind is difficult to discern. Oh my! Look at the time! We don't want to keep you past the witching hour, do we, dearies? I hope that you have enjoyed my little stories. You are always welcome to come and hear my weird tales and delve into the dark unknown with me anytime. Until next time, dearies, good night and pleasant dreams.
Thank you for listening to Weird Tales, The Puppet Master Murders. Weird Tales was created and adapted by Rachel Finis. The Haunter of the Ring was adapted from the story by Robert E. Howard, and The Cliff was adapted from the story by Itogawa Rampo. The Puppet Master Murders was directed by Rachel Finis with assistance from Sally Hale. Philippa Lovecraft was played by Linda Ward. John Kerouan was played by Ian Kinder. Jim Gordon was played by Zach Cornett. Evelyn Gordon was played by Angie Wilson. Dr. Donnelly was played by Josh Hunsinger. Bill Bain was played by Lawrence Schuler. Josef Vrolak was played by Daniel Phelps. The Woman was played by Teresa Whitaker. And Michael O'Donnell and the Man were played by Jackson Fong. Recording engineering by Howell Gatchell and post-production engineering by Jackson Fong and Rachel Finis. This is your announcer, Howell Gatchell, wishing you a good night and pleasant dreams.